door. He'd slam the door shut on the room. On us. On everything.
Chapter 37. Preppy.
"Where are you stomping off to?"
Bear asked, catching up to me as I was doing just that, angrily stomping down the shell driveway. He slapped me on the back of my shoulder.
"Everything okay back there?"
he asked, lighting a cigarette and jerking his chin back toward the garage. I was about to snap something back at him, my emotions all bubbling at the surface, a place I hated them to be. My mouth hung open, ready to fire off some sarcastic retort that would have Bear seeing right through me. But I stopped myself and shut my mouth when I saw the concern written all over Bear's burly face. Or maybe it was pity. Fuck. I'd already caused so much hurt for one lifetime. I couldn't stand to see him look that way. So I made a decision right then and there. My shit would be exactly that. My shit. I knew Bear and Grace well enough to know that if they knew how deep things ran with Dre, then they would take it on as their own problem. And for fuck's sake, our little family had enough fucking problems to add my shit to the fucking pile. I slapped a smile on my face and reached into Bear's cut, plucking his cigarettes from his pocket and tossing him back the pack after I'd slid one from the pack and lit it. "All is good, man. Just got a call from Patty, who runs the GG operation off Sunset Vista," I lied. "The mister in the grow room is leaking. Gotta go dry out her hallway runner and fix the leak before her fucking pacemaker stops. Gotta keep the GGs happy, keep growing that money."
"You sure that's it?"
Bear asked, scratching his head.
"I thought that maybe that girl..."
I cut him off. "That was fucking epic, right? Although I'm not gonna lie, at one point I think I felt your balls on my fucking leg, dude."
"Preppy,"
Bear said, still attempting to carry on some sort of serious conversation about my behavior. "Wasn't gonna happen. Not then. Not fucking ever. At least now I know what to get you for Christmas, a good ball trimmer, or maybe a wax if you're into the pain. On second thought, maybe I'll get waxed, might be something I'd dig." Bear's face began to lighten as he shifted his focus from Dre to my ridiculousness. The corners of his mouth turned upward into his signature cocky smile.
"That's where you're really fucked up. You had your fucking cock deep inside a hot chick and you were thinking about my balls? Sounds like that's your problem, not mine, motherfucker,"
Bear teased, punching me playfully in the shoulder.
"But hey, any girl who likes to be double stuffed will make a great BBB. She'll fit in just fine with the brothers."
The rumble of an engine started, and we both turned to where Wolf was mounting his bike. He rolled up slowly, and it wasn't until he stopped right next to where he was standing that I realized Dre was on the back. I almost dropped my cigarette, sending bits of red ash flitting around in the darkness when I caught it before it could hit the ground.
"You move quickly,"
Bear said to Dre with a knowing smile.
"Just getting a lift," Dre clipped. "I wanted to thank you for my audition," she said, stressing the word, "to be one of your club girls. But something came up and I decided to go another route."
"Okay to give her a ride?" Wolf asked Bear. "Shame, beautiful. Could have had a lot more fun,"
Bear said. He nodded to Wolf, who revved his engine in response. The look on Dre's face said everything and made me feel small. I'd broken everything into so many pieces there was no way in fuck it would ever be able to be put back together again. So I guess you could say my plan worked. But that didn't mean it wasn't tearing my fucking gut in two. I stayed the course, shifting on my preppy mask for Bear. I took a deep drag of my cigarette, casually blowing smoke rings into the air. "Real shame," I drawled. I grabbed my dick through my jeans. "Guess all this man meat scared her off." Bear laughed and turned back toward the house. I felt Dre's eyes on me until the bike was well out of sight, the engine nothing but an echo through the trees. And then she was gone. For good. Of course, fate is a nasty, evil bitch, because it was in that moment, one of the shittiest of my life, after a confusing yet fucking hot, unexpected threesome with one of my best friends, that I realized that the girl driving away wasn't just some girl I was saving from my twisted ass. She was the girl I was in love with. the girl I would always be in love with, until my very last breath.
Chapter 38. Dre. Hatred is easy. It's love that's hard. It wasn't the betrayal that hurt the most. It wasn't the lies or the deceit. It wasn't even the way he'd made me feel more used than Connor or Eric ever had. The way I felt had nothing to do with the bitterness that settled in my throat, so thick I was practically gagging on it. No. The thing that hurt the most wasn't the way things ended at all. It was the way it all began. It was the love. I didn't want it anymore. I shouldn't have even been there anymore, so I wished it away with everything I had. But no matter how much wishing and praying or meditating I did, nothing worked. Even though betrayal had moved in, love refused to pack its bags and get out. Fucking squatter. I wanted so badly for anger and rage to be my primary emotions, and so I focused on his bitter words that ended us. The way he looked at me with no remorse in his eyes. The way the door echoed as he slammed it shut. But I couldn't stay in the darkness too long, the light always finding its way inside my thoughts. And soon I was remembering the warmth of his skin against mine, the first time he touched me. The way he looked at me before he finally kissed me. The way he made me laugh in a time in my life when not a goddamn thing in the world was funny to me anymore. No. Love didn't magically turn into hate just because we want it to, because it's easier. I learned very quickly that it turns into something else, something much, much worse, a broken heart. Little did I know that the real breaking was yet to come, and the greatest lesson of all about love, I would be learning all too soon.
Chapter 39. Preppy. Myrna's house had been sitting vacant since that night it all went to shit. I'd still come by from time to time, although I hadn't used it as a GG since Dre left. All of the furniture was gone. All of the pictures. It had been over a year since Dre set foot in the place, yet I swore I could still smell her there. She was happy. She had to be. That's what I told myself anyway, in order to go through the motions and pretend like nothing was wrong. Her happiness was what kept one foot in front of the other, and the sometimes fake smile plastered on my face. Real smiles came in the form of King getting out of prison and him actually getting a girl. Or stole a girl. However you wanted to look at it. Doe was her name. She didn't have a memory, but she had a great set of tits and an attitude to boot. And I think that she was my friendship soulmate in a way. Although I never told her about Dre. I never told anyone. I told myself I was fine and the plan was to try to believe my own lie until it became true. After Dre left town, I'd come for my plants. There on the counter was my folder. She'd done it. She'd forged every single document I needed, but it was all for nothing. The judge assigned to the case denied my petition before a hearing was even called. Before I could utter a single fucking word. When the lawyer I was using told me the judge's name who wouldn't even grant me a hearing, it all became clear. I actually knew him. Well, I knew his sister. All I did was fuck her in a pool, a public one, with people around, but apparently word had gotten back to him and the cocksucker must not like voyeurism, because the gavel crashed down on my case, crushing any hope I had left of saving Max from the system. I was high as a kite when I got in my car, and filed the fake docs with the clerk's office. It wasn't necessary. It wouldn't change a damn thing. But I did it anyway. Maybe because it made her work, not for nothing. Maybe because filing the documents made her more than just a memory. It made her real. Because her time with me seemed more and more like a fading dream. But it was all too late. In the movies, the end of a person's life is slow moving, each fraction of a second drawn out. Seeming more like hours as they take their last breaths and watch the highlight reel of their lives play out before their eyes while some kind of Titanic-esque violin music plays in the background. It's all bullshit. Death is quick. Too fucking quick. I remember walking with my friends to go into the meet with Isaac. On the way, I saw this dark-haired girl with innocent cheeks, and for a second I thought she was Dre. She was staring at me, too, but when Dre's face faded, it was replaced by the wide-eyed look of another girl, one I was pretty sure had been on the sharp end of a preppy bear-fuck session a time or two. The reality of my own death was a searing pain ripping through my gut, followed by a sense of doom as I bled out onto the concrete. I didn't fade away. I dropped out of consciousness with lightning speed. I barely had time to register the horror on my friends' faces, who all seemed to be floating around above me like they were above the surface, while I was being dragged down to the dark depths below. I reached out, wanting to grab them, wanting to hold on to this life. But it was too fucking late. For most people, death was the end. For me, it was only the beginning.
Chapter 40. Dre. Tap, 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 tap. Mindlessly, I bounced my pen on top of my open textbook in such quick succession the pages vibrated, lifting at the corners. I shuffled my feet, crossing and uncrossing my ankles, wishing away the constant feeling of restlessness that only seemed to intensify with each passing day. My desk was pushed up sideways against the only window in the classroom, although there was no view to speak of, nothing but a brick wall. The small space between buildings was just large enough to allow in the rain that had just started to fall, beating up and sliding down the thick glass. The clouds overhead shifted, casting the already muted light of the room in a wash of gray. With the new lighting, the image in the window shifted, and suddenly I was no longer staring at the brick wall, but at the reflection of a girl. A girl whose hair had begun to shine again, although her ponytail could have used a smoothing, the humidity of the day sending every little hair not long enough to be tied in the elastic, standing on their tiny curly ends. She wore glasses, simple dark blue frames. Her complexion was pale, but not sallow. Her eyes tired, but not lost. I knew the girl was me, but beyond the clean clothes and classroom setting, I saw another girl, just beyond her shoulders, one who was slumped against a wall with a needle in her arm and cum in her hair. A girl who was trapped both physically and mentally. I shook my head, willing away the image of someone I never wanted to see again. I closed my eyes tightly, and when I opened them again, both girls were gone. The clouds cleared, and soon my reflection was gone as well, and I was again staring at nothing but an empty brick wall. Without thinking, I raised my hand to scratch at an itch that didn't really exist, with fingernails that weren't long enough yet to actually do any real scratching. The scabs and pockmarks were all gone, but in their place were the raised red scars, just starting to take on their shapes. Some of them were already turning their permanent shade of white, others lingering at bright red. The teacher was a man in his 60s. He stood with his back straight and his head down at the podium. His voice was monotone, with zero inflection, as he read off his lesson plan. I took a deep breath and tried paying attention, but everything he was covering, about the founding of our country and the Declaration of Independence, I'd learned in fifth grade. Leaning back in the chair, I crossed my arms over my chest, and since my feet didn't touch the floor, I swung my legs back and forth, accidentally kicking the chair of the boy in front of me. I started, but then the kid turned around, and the wind was knocked out of my chest when my eyes landed on the familiar, beautiful big smile and the tattoos covering his neck. I gasped, covering my mouth with my hand. Impossible. "Hey, watch it," he said, his unfamiliar, high-pitched voice bringing me back to reality, where he was just a dark-haired boy with olive skin, who didn't look anything at all like the man I mistook him for. "Sorry," I whispered. The boy turned back around to face the teacher, who'd turned off the lights so we could follow his slides on the overhead projector, which was blurry at best. The Sons of Liberty's heads were all large and skewed, distorted pictures of a probably already distorted tale of American history. It wasn't the first time his face appeared on someone else's, just like it wasn't the first time my stomach dropped with my disappointment when I realized it wasn't him. It would never be him. Later on that day, I sat in the small, cramped office space of Edna Ellenberry, my counselor whom my dad insisted I see 3 times a week, one of the many terms of my return home, and one I didn't really mind all that much. Edna was quirky and kind of funny. Being a recovering addict herself, she could relate to me in a way not a lot of other mental health professionals could. "I saw him again today," I told her, staring at the books and other knickknacks on the overstuffed bookcase in the corner. Lord of the Flies was on the top shelf, dangling over the edge. One heavy-footed passerby could send it crashing to the floor. "Brandon?" "No," I said, shaking my head. Brandon was someone who'd recently started working with my dad. He'd asked me out a few times, and even though he was good-looking and seemed nice enough, I just wasn't ready to complicate my life in a way it didn't need to be complicated. "Not Brandon. Him," I said, still finding it hard to utter his name without feeling a sense of sickness wash over me.
"That happens when we lose somebody we care about," Edna said,
watering each of the 30-some-odd plants in her little windowsill. She wore loose, light-faded jeans with a long, white ribbed sweater. Her bright red hair was something from the 80s, permed in tight curls and cut longer in the back and short on the top. She had pink lipstick on her teeth at all times.
"Especially one who had such a huge impact on your life. It will fade with time."
But what if I don't want it to fade?" I asked, realizing by asking the question it meant that I wasn't entirely sure that moving on was what I really wanted. Edna put down her watering can on the floor and sidestepped one of the 7 coffee tables in the cramped space, plopping down on the denim sofa and motioning for me to do the same on the one across from her. We both kicked off our shoes and sat Indian style across. She closed her eyes and took a deep breath, and I copied. When she opened her eyes, she asked,
"You cared for him a great deal, right?"
I nodded. He saved my life. Immediately, the words felt wrong. I know that I loved him, I corrected. And I just don't see him when I sleep. I hear him, too. In my head, chatting away and making jokes and being ridiculous. I trailed off, biting back tears. Edna smiled and reached across the coffee table to give me a reassuring pat on my knee. I watched her hand, but didn't jump away. Her smile grew brighter.
"Dre, when you love someone, it's very common to carry that person around with you until you're ready to let go. You hear their voice, you think you see them on the street, you dream about them at night. It's all very normal and a very healthy part of grief. It will fade with time, but only when you're ready."
I bit my lip. "I don't want him to leave," I said, surprising myself when the tears welled up in my eyes. Edna sidestepped the coffee table and sat down next to me, pulling me in and holding me tight against her ample breasts. Everything about her was comforting, and in a way she reminded me of a younger version of Myrna.
"He saved your life. It's natural that you feel something toward him, along with a sense of guilt because you lived and he didn't."
Edna paused, gathering her thoughts before she continued.
"You know, kid, it sounds to me like you still need that closure we've been talking about."
"Closure?" I squeaked. The idea of it sounded ridiculous. "I'm not sure about that. How can you close something that never really opened?" I felt myself starting to tear up and immediately felt embarrassed.
Oh, shucks, Doc. She nodded and handed me a tissue. Well, from what you've told me, you never gotten a chance to really grieve, to close that chapter in your life and move on. But I don't know how to get it, or if I even wanted it. I'll never forget the day my dad and I went down to Sarasota together to help transfer Myrna to a facility closer to our house. I was debating taking a solo ride down to Logan's Beach when one of the nurses mentioned his name, wondering why he stopped visiting. The other explained to her why he couldn't visit. He was dead. Right then and there, I couldn't breathe. My heart stopped. A piece of me died right there along with him. Edna held me tighter and rocked me back and forth like Myrna used to. She pulled me back and looked down to my hands where I was now staring. She snapped her fingers and smiled brightly. When you're ready, and only when you're ready, I think you should seek out those who cared about him. His friends, family, have a conversation. Talk about his life. I truly think it will help you find what you need. I'll think about it, I said, and I did. The only interaction I ever had with his friends was that one encounter from Bear. At least read the letter, Edna suggested. Maybe that will help you decide. She pulled out the envelope that had arrived a few months earlier, with no return address, just a stamp from the Logan's Beach post office. It's time, she said, handing it to me. Can you open it? I asked. Edna shook her head. No, that's for you to do, but I'll give you a minute alone, Edna said, patting me on the shoulder and stepping out of the room. I tore open the envelope quickly, thinking that if I did it fast, like a Band-Aid, it wouldn't hurt as much. I was wrong. Doc, there's this place where light and dark meet in the sky. When the sun's setting, where it's not quite day and not quite night. A grayish mist among the black and yellow. I like to think of it as a place where right and wrong, black and white, life and death aren't finite. I call that place the in-between. And to me, that's where you and I will always exist. Together. It's where we can't be hurt. Where our pasts don't haunt our present. Where there's no such thing as lies. Where pain isn't even a thing. We couldn't be together in this life. Maybe not even in the next. Who knows? My luck is pretty shit these days. But now when I think of you, which is still every fucking day, and when I can't catch my breath wondering what could have been, I drag my ass outside, I sit in the yard, and I wait for it. That brief glimpse of the changing of the guard in the sky. And every day, even though the pain cuts just as deep as the day you left, even though I know the truth is that I'll never see you again, I smile. Because you and I are there, and we'll always have the in-between. Love, Samuel Clearwater. Preppy, badass mofo. P.S. If you are receiving this, I'm dead. So I think it's safe to tell you that you are by far my biggest regret. The light amongst all my dark. I'm so sorry.
Chapter 41. Several months later. Dre. With Brandon sitting by my side on the plane to Florida, I was finally ready to go and seek the closure that my dad, counselor, and my sponsor were always so adamant about. As we flew over the still waters of the Caloosahatchee River, I tightened my grip on Brandon's hand. He offered me a reassuring smile and gave me a thumbs up, covering my hand with his own. He probably thought it was the flight that had me freaking out. And although flying wasn't my favorite activity in the world, it wasn't the fear of plummeting to the ground below that had my windpipe tightening like a guitar string as the plane descended. No. It was the water tower. The one that stuck out on the flat land, towering above the earth like a redneck Statue of Liberty, reaching up toward the plane. Its huge black spray-painted dick was in full frontal view as the landing gear clattered and screeched, locking into place. I wanted to both laugh and cry at the sight of it. Suddenly, it was all too real. I was going back. Back to where it all started. Back to where it all ended. Back to where it would only just begin. Chapter 42. Dre. I raised my trembling hand to the door and knocked. The sound of squealing children playing in the backyard echoing over the house. I was about to change my mind and turn around when a blonde girl with the lightest blue eyes I'd ever seen opened the door.
"Can I help you?"
she asked with a small but friendly smile.
Hi. I'm Andrea Capulet, but I go by Dre," I said, holding out my hand. She shook it tentatively. "I'm a friend, or I was a friend of Samuel's. Preppy's." My chest tightened as his name crossed my lips. It had been years, and although I expected that feeling to die off, it never had. If anything, it had only gotten worse. The girl remained silent, looking me over several times like she was trying to place me.
"I'm Ray," she finally offered. "What can I do for you?"
"Ray, hi. I just wondered..."
I trailed off, looking down to my feet.
"Do I know you?"
"She was going to be a BBB once," Bear said, coming to stand behind her. "You ain't here to drop off any kids with uncanny resemblance to people who may or may not be here, are you?"
he asked, and I couldn't quite tell if it was a joke. Shit, I was surprised he remembered me. But obviously, he didn't remember everything, because last time I checked, you couldn't get pregnant through anal. My cheeks grew red at my own thoughts. I shook my head.
"Hi, Bear," I said with a small, nervous wave. I pushed my glasses up on my nose.
Bear looked me over, and as if he'd decided I wasn't a threat, he'd turned around and went back inside the house. Ray seemed to agree.
"Well, come on in," she said, stepping aside.
Another large and equally beautiful man was sitting in the living room. He lifted his head and glanced at me briefly, before Bear sat back down and they both leaned over the coffee table, speaking softly, instantly deep in what seemed like an important conversation. Ray waved in their direction.
"Don't mind King and Bear. They've been a little crazy this past week with all that's gone down," she told me as she led me through a neat and newly updated living space that smelled of fresh paint and cleaning products, down a narrow hallway. My heels clacked against the shining hardwood. She stopped in front of a closed door. Preppy's door. Or what used to be Preppy's door. My heart stilled. I was suddenly mad at everyone who insisted that I come here and get closure by talking to his friends. It was too much. I wasn't ready. I couldn't breathe. My memories flooded with his face, his scent. Him. "No, I mean, I don't need to go in there." I started backing away from the door. Ray sighed.
"I know what you mean. It's hard to see at first. The prognosis shifts around a bit from doctor to doctor, but he's a fighter. We have hope and we have time."
"Huh?" I asked, confused as to what she was talking about, when she pushed open the door and stepped inside. Tentatively, I entered the room, taking a deep sigh of relief when I noticed the room wasn't at all like it used to be. Preppy's things were no longer there. The relief was followed by deep disappointment and a sick feeling, a longing for what once was, for who once was. The walls, once a deep blue, were now a bubblegum pink with stenciled daisies and clouds surrounding the window. A Cinderella lamp sat on a small white nightstand next to the bed.
"Of course his things weren't there, you idiot. Because he's..." I paused. My ears picked up a steady beeping sound. My eyes followed the sound across the room,
to the IV stand in the corner, set up next to a rollaway hospital bed. Lines raced across the screen that was mounted below the IV. Little green mountains peaked and fell, followed by a chirp of the machine, in even 2-second increments.
"I don't understand,"
I said, not allowing my eyes to travel to the bed. I wasn't sure if I was afraid of what I would see or what I wouldn't see, who I wouldn't see. I turned back around to face Ray.
Who is that?
I asked, dread and hope fighting a battle in the pit of my stomach and my heart. I pointed to the mound of blankets rising and falling in rhythm.
Wait. You don't know, do you?
Ray breathed.
I thought everyone in Logan's Beach knew by now.
I shook my head.
I'm not from here.
Not able to take another minute of my rapidly beating heart fighting its way out of my chest, I spun around, and small step by small step, I made my way over to the bed, where a shell of a man lay unconscious, with tubes running through his nose and mouth, his eyes and cheeks sunken in, his hands resting above the clean navy comforter. I didn't even need to see the tattoos running across his knuckles to know it was him. But there they were, in all their familiar glory. I let out a strangled cry that startled even myself, as hot tears fell down my face. Elation and an overwhelming feeling of confusion smashed into me, like I was finally run over by that train. I leaned over him, careful not to disturb any of the tubes, pressed the side of my face against his chest. I needed to hear it for myself, and sure enough, it was there. The thump, thump, the most beautiful sound in the world. His heart. Beating. Heavy footsteps entered the room. King, Bear, and a girl with pinkish-red hair stood around the doorway, gaping at me as if I were the one risen from the dead.
How?
I asked, without moving my head from his chest. My hand covered one of his own and squeezed as I breathed deeply, inhaling this new life, inhaling him.
You really didn't know?
King asked skeptically, pulling Ray into his chest.
Thought everyone knew.
No,
I said, although no sound came out, so I just mouthed the word.
I didn't know anything.
What's going on?
The pink-haired girl asked. Bear wrapped his arms protectively over her waist, which was when I noticed her rounded belly. Bear leaned down and whispered in her ear. She nodded in some sort of understanding, but continued to stare me down like she was unsure of me at best. But that didn't matter. She didn't matter. Nothing mattered. Overwhelming joy consumed my entire being. How he was alive didn't matter just then. All that mattered was that he was alive. My Preppy. My Samuel.
Who exactly are you again?
Ray asked, staring at me as I practically laid across Preppy's body. Reluctantly, I lifted my head from his chest, although I kept my hand over his. I sniffled and wiped the tears streaming down my face. I took a deep breath to steady myself, and when I spoke, I made sure I was looking at each and every one of Preppy's friends. I was about to speak when I was interrupted by a scratchy voice. I spun around and was met with bloodshot amber eyes that were locked onto mine when he spoke.
She's my wife.
The end. For now.
This has been Preppy. The Life and Death of Samuel Clearwater, Part 1, King Series, Book 5. Written by T.M. Frazier. Narrated by Kirsten Lee and Lance Greenfield at Brickshop Audio, Inc. Copyright 2016 by T.M. Frazier. Production copyright 2016 by T.M. Frazier.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.